Hi there! Welcome to Explain This, a podcast where we try to explain complex things in simpler ways for people of all ages. I'm your host, Jun Kim, back from my intense fellowship exam that I've been studying for the past year, plus a well-deserved two-week break. Today we're going to talk about the replication crisis, a major crisis in the world of science that you might not have even heard about before today. But you should, because, well, it might completely undermine your general knowledge base. Let's get started. I've always loved weird and wonderful psychology experiments that show just how fantastically complex and quirky our brains are. Like the marshmallow experiment that showed that kids who can delay gratification and hold off eating a marshmallow in front of them will do better in the SATs and be more successful as an adult. Or the theory of ego depletion, where studies have shown that we can use up, so to speak, our willpower and mental energy, so we're less capable of doing mental tasks after restraining ourselves. Don't forget the power pose experiment, now well known through the TED Talk, where a researcher showed that by assuming empowering poses before a job interview or a presentation, you can decrease your stress level and boost your testosterone to feel confident. Then there are the dark experiments, like the infamous Milgram experiment, where random citizens could easily be prompted into delivering lethal doses of electricity just because a guy in the lab coat asked them to. Or the Stanford experiment, where university students immediately assumed the role of prison guards and beat their fellow students just because they were prompted. Or the famous bystander effect, where over 30 people watched a young woman getting murdered without calling for help because, well, they all thought someone else would do it instead. You've probably heard of at least one of these experiments or studies because people love talking about weird, exciting new psychology discoveries. But what if I told you that many of these experiments and effects aren't true? What if I told you that, as pioneering and foundational these studies seem to be, that the described effects aren't really reproducible in other well-designed studies? And no, this is not some crockpot conspiracy theory that 2021 seems to be full of. This, my friends, is the replication crisis. Before we delve into questioning the integrity and validity of modern science, let's briefly explain the replication crisis to you as if you were a child. How do we know that something is true? We live in an exciting world where there is so much to learn about everything. People all over the world have been learning about how the universe works for thousands of years. So over time, we've gotten pretty good at it. This is what science is all about. It's all about scientists doing a lot of thinking and experimenting and pondering and testing to figure out how things work. Then, they have to show they're working to their friends, who go over it like a teacher marking your homework, to make sure you've done everything right. Because we don't want no fake news or misunderstandings, like thinking that diseases spread by bad smells or that the sun goes around the earth or anything like that. And then, scientists have to repeat another scientist's experiments to prove that the result is the same. Because if someone told you that dropping Mentos in Diet Coke leads to a foamy explosion, but it doesn't work when you try it, how disappointed would you be? So this is why you should trust experts and the scientific method. It's a rigorous way to find truth backed by cold, hard evidence that you can reproduce and copy. Except, recently, we've found that many things we thought we knew about the world, everywhere from psychology to medicine to economics, might not be true. We thought they were robust truths with plenty of evidence, but when some curious scientists tried to repeat the experiments, they couldn't get the same results. It's like trying to build an awesome Lego spaceship using the included instruction book, but you keep ending up with a broken pile of bricks instead. Could the instruction book be wrong? And the more scientists look back and retest old ideas and experiments, the more we're finding don't hold up. Which is pretty bad, since modern science is all about being able to repeat and replicate the results. It's all about having an accurate Lego instruction book that works. Because otherwise, we'd have some pretty disappointed kids all around the world. So it's a real crisis, and we need to find a way to fix it. Welcome back. So before we talk about the replication crisis and what it is, we have to cover a very important topic, and that's how modern science works. Because you can't talk about how something might be broken without understanding how it works in the first place. Modern science is based on a revolutionary way of thinking called the scientific method. For as long as human beings have existed, there have always been clever cookies that wanted to understand how the world around us worked. But before the scientific method, the vast majority of knowledge came from observation and trying to figure out the cause and effect. For a very long time, that came in the form of mythology. Like, the sun rises from the east each morning and sets in the west because the sun god drives his shining chariot across the sky and around the earth each day. Or volcanoes are because the god of the forge is crafting new inventions and needs a really, really hot forge. Over time, thinkers such as Thales of Miletus and Plato and Aristoteles moved from myths to rational thinking as the basis of understanding the world. Ancient Greek philosophers again focused on cause and effect, but they applied the tools of induction, where you observe things and come up with a probable explanation that sums up what you observe. This is better than mythology, but it's still not perfect because, as we know, correlation doesn't mean causation. This is why we hear wacky stories like how Aristoteles thought that eels spontaneously appear from mud, because he couldn't ever find eels having reproductive organs. Therefore, they must appear from somewhere else, right? And mud seems like a good answer as any. So over time, great thinkers like Francis Bacon, Descartes, and Galileo started questioning the old Aristotelian method of quote-unquote science. They thought more rational thinking and actual experimental data was needed to prove that something was true. And this is when modern science was born, along with the scientific method. The scientific method is a rigorous cyclical process that goes like this. First, you observe or question something. Second, you research what you can to see if other people have come up with an answer or what we know about it already. Third, from everything observed and researched, you come up with a hypothesis, kind of a working theory or assumption that you can test. It's very important that this hypothesis is falsifiable, which means it can be proven wrong, because otherwise it's meaningless since you'll never find proof. This is why religion and science aren't opposites, they're completely different fields. Because science is only looking at things that it can prove wrong, because otherwise how can you prove it right? Okay, now that we have a hypothesis, we can test it through experiments. Experiments give us data, which we can analyze to see if the hypothesis is true or false, and we can even see how right we were. Lastly, the conclusions are reported to the world and all other scientists, who can examine our method and data and our analyses to see if we messed up in any way, like miscalculating or using shoddy data or misinterpreting something because of conflicting factors or bias. Then the cycle starts again, and science evolves and refines itself over time. The bottom line is, modern science is based on observing something, coming up with a hypothesis, testing that hypothesis, analyzing the data, then producing cold, hard proof that other scientists can examine for errors, then reproduce so that they can say, yes, Jen's math checks out because we can repeat his results. And that's why science is so reliable. It has multiple fail-safes built in to ensure that the conclusions we end up with are solid. And this is where the replication crisis comes in. Because like we talked about a few times already, some things happened in the past 10 to 15 years where it's been shown that many things we thought we know thanks to the scientific method might not be reliable or even true. Which is a huge deal because the scientific method is awesome and we want to make sure that we haven't been wasting the past 500 years learning the wrong things. So let's take a short break and then we'll talk about what the replication crisis is actually about. And we're back. Alright, so now that we know all about the scientific method and how reliable modern science should be, let's talk about how it might not be. Around 2005, a physician named John Ioannidis published a now infamous paper called Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. In this essay, Ioannidis highlighted that an uncomfortably large number of medical research papers could not be replicated. That is, if you repeated the same study with the same methodology and same analysis techniques, you wouldn't end up with the same results as the original author. This is a real issue because in medicine, we're relying on the scientific method to tell us what treatments are effective and worth doing, using solid methods and hard evidence. That's literally the point of science, replicable and reproducible hypothesis testing. The scientific method is what separates us, the cool, sexy modern doctors with our evidence-based antibiotics and vaccines and hand hygiene, from the old-school quack doctors removing people's teeth to treat psychosis and telling women that emotional outbursts come from the uterus, hence the word hysteria. But to suggest that the scientific method might be failing us? That was extremely controversial, to say the least. Thankfully, turns out it's not really the scientific method itself that's a lie. No, that would truly be earth-shattering. But turns out, the issue is that researchers and scientists are human beings, and we're not perfect. For example, Ioannidis found that a common reason that studies aren't backed up by replication is because people aren't replicating the experiments enough. Out of 45 big-time medical studies from the previous decade with more than 1,000 citations, Ioannidis found that only 44% were successfully replicated. Less than half! In fact, 24% of the studies had remained basically unchallenged, 16% were found to have much weaker effects in subsequent studies, and in 16% of cases, the effects were completely contradicted by future studies. And it's not just one isolated study that showed the discrepancy. In 2012, a study showed that only 11% of 53 cancer studies could be replicated, meaning that the other 89% either were wrong or at least insignificant. The findings shocked the science community because, up until then, we had faith in the system that we would produce reliable, robust, and replicable results that would add to our knowledge base about how the world functions and how things work. Other fields such as psychology and economics turned their attention to their own studies, and the results were astounding. One paper from 2008 named Estimating the Reproducibility of Psychological Science looked at 100 famous psychology results from top-tier journals, and found that only 39% were reproducible. Other similar studies have found replication rates of about 23 to 48%, meaning less than half of reported psychology results could be successfully reproduced. In fact, the famous science journal Nature even ran a survey on over 1,500 researchers about this very issue. Turns out, more than 70% of researchers had tried and failed to reproduce another scientist's work, with more than half failing to reproduce their own results. More importantly, 52%, over half, of the researchers agreed that there is a significant crisis of reproducibility and replication. This is huge! The fact that over half of the new research and results coming out from the world of science might be meaningless or incorrect is paradigm shifting, because the point of the scientific method was to remove this uncertainty about the validity of results. All of those famous psychology experiments that I mentioned at the start, the Stanford Prison Experiment, the Marshmallow Experiment, power poses, ego depletion, have all been contradicted or debunked by repeat experiments that didn't show the results that the original author suggested. So, turns out, a major chunk of your cool facts that you talk about at the bar about the human psyche might just be plain wrong. And more importantly, turns out science has a huge problem right now with figuring out what we thought we know to be true is actually true or not. This is the replication crisis. And yes, it is a crisis, not just an issue, because it spans the entire field of science, from the natural sciences to the social sciences. So, how did the replication crisis come to be? Well, the short answer is, researchers and scientists are human, and turns out human beings are very fallible for various reasons. It's kind of why we came up with the scientific method in the first place, to overcome these factors. If you look at the studies that can't be replicated, there are usually some common themes. First, many studies have flaws in their experiment methods, meaning they're not following the rigorous scientific method properly. This may include not properly blinding the study, meaning that the researchers knew which subjects were given the actual treatment versus the placebo or the control. This opens up room for cognitive bias to sneak in, like overinterpreting results because you think, oh, this must have happened because we gave the treatment, rather than random chance or variance causing the result. Other methodology flaws include not studying enough people. The smaller the group studied, the larger the statistical variance. For example, we all know that a coin flip has a 50-50 chance of heads or tails. So, by this logic, the chance of getting two heads in a row is 0.5 times 0.5, which is 0.25, meaning there's a 25% chance. But if you flip some coins yourself, you'll find that it's not always 1 out of 4 times that you'll get two heads in a row. This is because probabilities work over much larger numbers or population sizes. This is why you get people less educated in statistics being misguided how random chance actually works, or the efficacy of medical treatments like vaccines, because they rely on personal experience, anecdotes, and overall very small sample sizes. You could say, oh, I flipped a coin 5 times in a row, therefore it can't be 2 over to the power of 5 chance, which is 1 over 32. Side note, did you know that randomization algorithms, like the ones that let you shuffle your playlist, have modifications put in to avoid playing the same song twice? If it was truly random, the chance of playing the same song twice is the same as the chance of any two specific songs in a row. So, of course it's going to happen often enough if you have a small enough playlist. But because most people don't understand this kind of probability, developers have had to tweak algorithms to appear more random to human beings than actual mathematical randomness. Because people keep complaining, oh, my playlist isn't random, I just heard the same song twice. Anyway, but even when it comes to highly trained scientists who are supposed to understand these concepts, you run into issues of studies with tiny sample sizes, which means you don't get enough mathematical certainty that a discovered effect isn't actually due to random chance. A famous example is a study that showed, quote-unquote, evidence of people having future sight, or ESP, because they could guess in the study with slightly above 50% chance whether there was a picture behind a curtain or not. Turned out, the sample size was nowhere near big enough. If they had repeated the same study with many more people, they'd find that the probability homes back towards the 50% range, because people can't see into the future, so they're guessing. And if you guess a small number of times, the chances that you might be right increase. But if you repeat the same experiment millions of times, then statistics prevails and you get the actual chance, which is 50%. Now, you might think, hang on, shouldn't scientists have some kind of way to standardize how likely a result is due to random chance versus a real effect? And you'd be right, because you're very smart. Anyone who has done some level of science or statistics might be familiar with something called the p-value. This is a number that tells us exactly what we're talking about. What is the probability that the result of an experiment was due to random chance, i.e. that this is a false positive? The smaller the p-value, the less likely the result is due to random chance. In science, the default agreed upon acceptable p-value is 0.05, meaning there's a less than 5% chance that the results are due to coincidence. The problem is that this still means there's a 5% chance that what you discovered isn't a real effect, but just coincidence. Furthermore, there's an infamous practice in science called p-hacking, which has come to light recently, which is an intentional abuse of the p-value. Long story short, you can manipulate the p-value of your experiment by testing more and more people until your p-value is just under 0.05. Had you just tested a large number of people all at once, your p-value might have been easily over 0.05, meaning your result is statistically not significant. But p-hacking lets you tweak your p-value, one result at a time, until you get exactly what you want. Which means that when you publish your paper, it looks like your study result is really, really statistically significant, when it's kind of been manipulated to show that. It's kind of like when you measure your weight repeatedly throughout the day until you get the lowest weight possible, and you stick with that. I mean, don't look at me, I don't do that, usually. Now, there's actually a great XKCD comic that shows this using the example of jelly beans and acne that I'll post in the show notes. I love that there's always a relevant XKCD comic. Now, similarly, researchers might selectively report results, like only publishing papers that showed some effect, while not mentioning the other studies that were inconclusive. If you did 10 studies and 9 of them didn't show an effect and 1 did, well, then it's probably likely that that 1 out of 10 study wasn't real. But if you report just that one, voila, an effect has been found. Intentionally manipulating data and falsifying results is fortunately not too common in the scientific world, but it does still happen time to time. So this is why replication is so important, to avoid people getting swayed by false data. Like, you know, when a doctor made up results to make it look like the MMR vaccine caused autism, when countless studies have disproved that since. It still caused a massive amount of damage by fueling the anti-vaccination movement and resulting in the death and disability of way too many children across the world. More often than not, human error and other external pressures are responsible for biases that fuel the replication crisis. Perhaps one of the biggest factors that fuel the replication crisis is how the world of science currently works. We live in a wonderful age where there are millions of researchers all around the world, discovering all kinds of cool, niche things in their respective fields. But this also means that each year, over 1 million papers are being published. Now, this has a few implications. First, it's just really hard to replicate all of these studies, because replication studies themselves take time and resources. This is why so little replication is actually done, to double-check if a result is really true or not. Hell, only 1-2% of all psychology studies were replication studies, according to one review. That's a tiny number considering the scientific method relies on replication to confirm the validity of new findings. Secondly, there's a fierce competition for your paper to be published, because of the sheer numbers. This means that studies that produce exciting, game-changing results and are just so hot right now are more likely to be published over studies that say, yeah, that cool hypothesis we had, turns out we can prove it wrong, so we're back to status quo. Or, yep, that other research group really did figure out a cool new thing, we just copied the exact same methods and got the same results. Overall, scientists showing off exciting results are much more likely to see their works published in famous science journals, and that means they get more funding and promotions, and their name gets known in the academic world. Which is unfortunate, because scientists are human beings working a job too, like any Bob or Jane, so they are motivated to be published and get their work seen by the world. So there's huge pressure to keep pushing to discover the next hot new thing, even if it's a false positive, rather than replicating studies or reporting inconclusive results. Take the example of the power pose that took the world by storm in 2012. After the researcher did a cool TED talk, inspiring people to pose in front of a mirror before a job interview to boost their confidence and hormones and reduce their stress levels. Now, it turned out that the original study only studied 42 people, which is tiny in the world of studies. And no subsequent study with better methodology and study designs could replicate the power pose effect. Turned out, the power pose was just wishful thinking with flawed data to back it. Even one of the original authors of the study retracted their findings a few years later. But still, because it was such a hip, cool-sounding effect, and because there's a TED talk associated with it, the idea spread globally and is still touted by business people and self-help books, even though it's been proven to be pseudoscience. Which brings us to another point, media. I hope by now we all know that we shouldn't take what we see in the newspapers, let alone social media feeds, at face value, because the media by nature has to sensationalize stories to sell headlines. The media makes the replication crisis so much worse, because as soon as a possibly promising new result is published, the media blows it up as certain fact. Because the media doesn't care about the scientific method or cautious reporting, they want flashy news. So they ignore all the basic statistical principles, such as correlation does not equal causation. For example, if you made a graph comparing the number of Nicolas Cage movies per year and the number of people drowning in swimming pools, you get a graph that eerily matches up. But that doesn't mean that Nicolas Cage movies are causing drownings. Maybe, who knows? No, they definitely aren't. Anyway, one of the best examples of sensationalized media affecting science knowledge in the general population is the bystander effect. If you haven't heard of the bystander effect, it's a psychology theory that states that when people are in a group setting, they're much less likely to help someone compared to when it's one-on-one. It's highlighted by the unfortunate case of Kitty Genovese, a 28-year-old woman who was murdered in 1964 outside her apartment. The original story reported that there were a whopping 38 witnesses who saw or heard the attack, yet none of them called the police or went to help her, despite hearing her screams. And that's terrible, right? No wonder why the world is going to hell. We're all bastard-coated bastards with a bastard filling. Who can't be bothered calling the police when someone is literally getting murdered. Blah blah blah, rant rant rant. But of course by now you've picked up the trend, that a lot of what you thought you knew about pop psychology is either technically incorrect or blatantly wrong. In the case of the Kitty Genovese case, we've since learned that the story isn't nearly as simple as we thought. Turns out that the original New York Times article that covered this story had many errors. For example, it transpired that there were only a dozen witnesses, and none of them were able to see or hear the events in its entirety, which paints a completely different picture to the original portrayal of 38 people coldly watching the murder unfold from their veranda without lifting a finger to help. In fact, most of the witnesses didn't even know that a murder was taking place because all they could hear were a few scuffles and yells. They thought it was a minor quarreling. Also, the police were definitely called during the incident, twice in fact. And unlike the original story that painted Kitty Genovese dying alone in the empty street, there was an elderly woman who had come to comfort her while the police and paramedics were coming. So, turns out that the iconic case that is taught in introductory psychology textbooks all over the world wasn't nearly as dramatic as people had imagined. Yes, it was still horrific that a murder happened, but people still called for help and rushed to her aid. People aren't all terrible, who knew? And again, in classic replication crisis fashion, recent studies that re-examine how people behave in similar situations have found that an overwhelming majority, over 90% of people, come to the aid of people in trouble, whether they're on their own or in a group setting. Great, yet another cool pop psychology fact debunked. You can see how sensational reporting of the case and the original non-replicated study results can cause generations of psychologists to learn about an effect that doesn't even exist. I hope by now I've convinced you how serious and widespread the replication crisis is. It's everywhere. There's a good chance that many of the interesting psychology facts you learned from books and documentaries and flipping BuzzFeed is outdated, flat out wrong, or at least not as strong of an effect as it was originally published. So now that we know what the replication crisis is and why it might have happened, let's take a short break, then talk about why it's a problem, why it's important to know about it, and how we might fight back against it to preserve the sanctity of modern science. Welcome back. We've talked a lot about psychology and medicine because they're two fields heavily affected by the replication crisis. But the replication crisis affects every scientific discipline. Let's study an example from physics to explore how dangerous the replication crisis can be and how it can affect our lives. Back in 2011, a physics experiment involving subatomic particles called neutrinos caused a huge ruckus in the academic world. The study seemed to suggest that neutrinos were faster than light, which has a massive implication because, according to Einstein's theory of special relativity, nothing can ever be faster than light. If we were to discover something that could travel faster than light, it would completely overturn everything we thought we knew about physics, and might even open the door to faster-than-light space travel, a cornerstone of science fiction. Now, a very important point in this story is that even the researchers who published this result thought something was fishy. They went over their data over and over and over, using various different analytical tools, to try to find some calculation error or typo or something that could explain this anomaly. Even when they published the results, they added that they intend to follow the result up with more studies to see if the result could be replicated, or if there's an alternative explanation other than Einstein was wrong. Which is exactly how science is supposed to run. You need to do due diligence to prove that you've removed human factors and bias and statistical errors, so the result you came to might actually be true. I mean, paradigm shifts happen all the time in scientific history. Remember how we used to think diseases were transmitted by miasma or bad smells, and it took ages for scientists to prove and convince everyone that, actually, diseases are due to tiny microscopic organisms that you can't see with your eyes? And the time when it turned out that doctors were accidentally killing a bunch of women because they didn't wash their hands after dissecting cadavers, causing fatal infections when they were delivering babies with dirty hands? So it's important to still report on these seemingly far-fetched and possible results, because science isn't about being right. It's about getting closer and closer to the truth. If you ask any scientist, they'll say that you can never know anything with 100% certainty. You can only say that this is the most likely explanation, or there's a very, very high probability that this is why, according to evidence. That's another key pillar of science. You have to be open to the fact that you might be wrong, and that's okay. Anyway, after the neutrino result was published, scientists immediately combed through the original study and set up replication studies. Eventually, the original group discovered a faulty fiber optic cable attachment that resulted in the anomaly. Multiple other big studies then confirmed that, no, neutrinos are definitely not faster than light. Whew! Now consider this. Here's an example where the scientists did all the right things, going over their results multiple times with various analysis tools, publishing the results with skepticism rather than certainty, and inviting other scientists to review and replicate their results to check if the results are indeed reproducible, or if they're a fluke. And even then, the world of physics nearly got overturned. So imagine what would have happened in a world of pseudoscience or alternative medicine where the scientific method isn't used. If scientists didn't follow the scientific method and just said, oh cool, neutrinos are faster than light, who knew? Let's start working on that cool warp drive engine from the movies using this new technology. We would have wasted a ton of precious time and resources going down a rabbit hole based on false results due to equipment failure. And this is why it's so important that the replication crisis has come to light and scientists are aware of it. Because science is built on the shoulders of giants. Knowledge evolves and refines over time to build a sturdy pyramid. If you have bad bricks based on wrong information, it can cause misinformation, wasting of resources, and veering further away from the truth. If the false facts are canonized as truth, the next generation of scientists will start their knowledge journey on faulty foundations. Policymakers will make the wrong decisions, like subsidizing fossil fuel or legalizing cigarettes, despite mountains of research eventually proving that they cause significant harm. It affects people on an individual level too. Recently, there's been the issue of people taking ivermectin, an anti-parasite drug, at toxic doses because they thought it might ward off COVID-19, according to a very flawed study. even though it's been concretely proven to have no benefit and will actually cause a lot more harm instead because of the toxicity. False information also is a breeding ground for malicious people using the shoddy data to peddle their own self-interest and greed, touting that they're using science, when in reality, they're using bad data with bad methodology, which isn't what science is about. You also have the issue of people claiming that, because of the replication crisis, all of science can't be trusted, which is blatantly false. The issue of the replication crisis is that there is an issue with how the scientific method has been carried out, not that the scientific method is wrong. All it means is that we need to be more rigorous, testing larger sample sizes, repeating studies to check that something is reproducible, and encouraging scientists to publish research that shows inconclusive evidence or disproving a previous study. Which ties us nicely into the most important topic. How do we fix the replication crisis? The replication crisis shook the academic world because suddenly we had to re-examine how we were approaching the scientific method. Like any tool, no matter how powerful or useful it is, if you don't wield it properly, it can be useless, or even worse, harmful. That's why it's called a replication crisis, not just a replication problem. Scientists really are taking this issue seriously because they understand all of the consequences it brings. This created a whole new field of study, meta-science, that is, the science of how to do science. So meta, so hot. Anyway, the first step of solving any problem is understanding the problem and acknowledging that it exists. Check, we've done that pretty well so far. The next is refining the way we practice science. We've talked about how a common way the replication crisis manifests is when poor methodology is used, such as too small of a sample size, or not bothering to see if the results are reproducible. So, scientists are working to improve standards, calling for more rigorous methodology and improved peer review systems, where scholars review each other's work before publishing to identify biases and errors before the world even sees it. And overall, people want to tighten up scientific practices, such as using larger sample sizes and even smaller p-values, like 0.005, or a 0.5% chance that the result is due to random chance. The other important step is reducing the external pressures that let the replication crisis grow and fester. As we mentioned before, one of the key issues is that by nature of competitiveness, journals and research institutions inherently reward scientists who produce exciting, shocking results. So, instead, there are institutions that have formed to incentivize scientists to replicate previous studies, to confirm results, and check reproducibility. There are also groups now that fund all research, whether it's a replication study or a study that shows an insignificant, inconclusive result, because inconclusive results add to science just as much as the conclusive, exciting ones. Also, there's an increasing call for the concept of open science, where data is publicly shared so everyone can access larger pools of data and check over other people's work to reduce errors. Overall, the world is becoming increasingly aware of publication bias and finding ways to reduce it so that the quality of science improves over time. Huzzah! The replication crisis is just a great example of the scientific approach to truth. It's human nature to want to be right and stick to our guns because we don't want to admit that we're wrong. But science teaches us that it's okay to be wrong. In fact, it encourages it, because it just creates more opportunities to retest things, explore things from a different perspective, or try novel approaches. If we never admitted we were wrong, then we'd never progress. Take for example how Galileo and Newton challenged the laws of physics as proposed by Aristoteles, touted as true for over 1,000 years. If they hadn't dared to suggest that Aristoteles might be wrong and performed countless experiments to prove that, actually, gravity works pretty differently to what Aristoteles thought in ancient Greece, then we might not have ever made rockets to land people on the moon. And that's the cool thing about science. It's not perfect, it's not without flaws, but science accepts all of that and just keeps striving to be better, the same as all of us should be striving. And I think that's pretty damn mathematical. So, what do we learn today? We learned about the scientific method, how modern science discovers things through observation, hypothesizing, experimenting, analyzing, then seeing if you can do the same experiment again and replicate the results to confirm that what you found is consistent. We learned about the replication crisis, the recent realization that a lot of what we thought we knew in science might actually be wrong, because we can't replicate the results of many cool, exciting studies that we've been talking and learning about. We learned about statistical errors, cognitive biases, p-hacking, and publication biases that all result in scientists straying from the scientific method and inadvertently publishing unreliable or over-exaggerated results that might not tell the whole truth. We learned about how the replication crisis can undermine scientific progress and can directly affect our lives when people abuse misinformation and disinformation for their greedy self-interests. We learned about how we can tackle the replication crisis in the scientific world with science, because science is awesome and amazing, and it's okay to be wrong. Okay, for today's 2-Minute Explain, I thought I'd talk more about a simple-sounding but fascinating scientific problem that has only been solved recently that I mentioned earlier in the episode. How do eels make babies? This sounds silly because you already know about how when a mummy eel and a daddy eel really love each other, they have sexual intercourse and produce offspring. But weirdly, for 2,000 years, we couldn't prove that this was the case. No, seriously, no matter how hard we tried and how many eels we dissect, we just couldn't find any evidence of eels having reproductive organs. Gonads, testicles, whatever you want to call them. One of the earliest examples is Aristoteles. He tried and tried, but couldn't find any evidence of eel sex, eel eggs, or baby eels, even though adult eels were everywhere. Therefore, he concluded that, of course, the eels must be spontaneously born from mud. Obviously. Other great thinkers over the ages hypothesized that they come from rock scrapings, hatch from rooftops, or even emerge from bug corpses. By the Renaissance, people started questioning whether eels really just spontaneously generated, but they couldn't come up with an alternative answer. Because even after dissecting thousands and thousands of eels, no one could find an eel with testicles. Are there just no male eels? Hell, even eel ovaries were only discovered in the 18th century. Even as recently as 100 years ago, the famous psychologist Sigmund Freud started his academic years studying zoology, but he gave up and pursued psychology instead because he couldn't find those dang eel gonads. I wonder if that influenced his psychology in the future. So, where do eels come from? Well, turns out eels aren't magical mud elementals, and they reproduce sexually like any other animal. The trouble is that the eel life cycle is quite complicated. It involves 5 stages, where the eel looks vastly different. When eels first hatch, they look like tiny transparent filaments called leptocephali. They then grow into what we call glass eels, tiny translucent stringy-looking things. Now, naturalists throughout history knew about leptocephali and glass eels, but no one knew they were baby eels because they look so different to adult eels. Also, eels only grow their sex organs when they fully mature, but the eels found in European rivers are only adolescents. I bet human puberty would be much less confusing if we didn't grow sex organs until we were fully mature. Anyway, freshwater eels migrate all the way to the freaking Bermuda Triangle to mature and mate. From there, teeny tiny leptocephali hatch from eggs in the deep sea, then migrate throughout the world, returning to the rivers where they're familiar to us. So you can forgive scientists for not being able to figure this out before they had microscopes and advanced ocean surveying technology. Because who would have thunk that glass eels were baby yellow eels, and that freshwater eels go to salt water to reproduce? It's only exactly 100 years ago in 1921 that we found evidence of leptocephali in the Sargasso Sea, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, proving that's where eels mate and breed. But even now, we still haven't found examples of eel sex or even eel eggs. Isn't that fascinating? With all our technology and knowledge, there are still wonders of eel sex to discover. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Explain This. I hope you've learned something interesting and maybe even useful today. We're back to recording regularly now, so look forward to a hot new episode every second Friday. And as always, I'd love it if you'd email or message me any feedback or suggestions for a new topic. So, until next time, bye for now. Explain This was written and hosted by me, Jin Kim. If you'd like to suggest a topic or just send a lovely message, you can email me at explainthiscast@gmail.com or follow me on Facebook or Twitter.